So our first case for argument, Vodak versus Chicago, Mr. Mogul.
Good morning. Joey Mogul here on...
Sorry. Ms. Mogul, sorry.
Okay. Joey Mogul of the People's Law Office here on behalf of the plaintiffs and Vodak. May it please the Court. The District Court, in granting summary judgment to the defendants on plaintiffs' First and Fourth Amendment claims, was improperly granted on plaintiffs' Fourth and First Amendment claims. And the District Court, in granting summary judgment to the defendants, failed to or ignored the law of ratification clearly established in Cox versus Louisiana, and ignored the fact that the Chicago Police Department was empowered to waive the advance permit requirement. And the court failed to take into account...
Why not get a permit and just leave the day open?
Pursuant to the City of Chicago's own standards, you cannot get a permit without knowing the date in question. In this case, this was a demonstration
Where does that come from?
It comes from the permit regulations of the Chicago Police Department and the permit application.
Is that an ordinance or just a police regulation?
I believe it's the police regulation. It's on the permit requirement itself. And in this case, there are facts that indicate members of the march contacted the Chicago Police to discuss the possibility of a march, and they were told that without a date, they could not get it. So in this case, the march organizers were planning for the march to begin the day after.
Is it feasible to have a permit with an open date?
That's not my understanding, Your Honor. In this case, we deposed Michael Simon. He was the person who was responsible for issuing permits.
I'm asking you, would it be feasible, not whether it would be permitted by the cops. Would it be feasible to have a permit with an open date?
I'm unaware. I don't know. Pursuant to the logistics that they need to consider, is it possible? Could the Chicago Police Department allow for that? In essence, they do. In the fact that they empowered the Chicago Police Department to waive the permit requirement and allow for a march to proceed in the streets. And that is an undisputed fact in this record.
Now, I was just thinking it would be easier for the police if there were a permit which defined, you know, in writing and so on, exactly where the demonstrators were going to be, so the police would know how to deploy their forces, wouldn't it?
Well, I think it would be wise for the Chicago Police Department and the City of Chicago to allow a permit without a specific date. That's not the facts or the circumstances we had here today.
Curious, what do you think?
In this case, there were 5,000 to 10,000 people who showed up at Federal Plaza to protest the Iraq War. They were exercising their First Amendment rights to do so.
So could I just ask you, though, to focus a little bit on at what point your Fourth Amendment argument focuses, and also, for that matter, the First Amendment, because the arrests, I thought, that were the motivating factor here don't happen until the end of the day, by the time people have turned off on Oak Street and they're back down fairly near the water tower on Chicago. So the fact that they... So of what relevance is the origin of the march in Federal Plaza?
In this case, the origin of the march in and of itself is relevant in the sense that the Chicago Police Department never advised individuals that there was no permit to march. They never warned people that if they marched, they would be arrested. And instead, they waived the permit and allowed the march. Where the district court granted summary judgment to the defendants, saying they were immune for arresting individuals for marching without a permit, it's relevant to the fact that at the beginning of this march, throughout its entirety to the end, the Chicago Police Department failed and to indicate to the marchers there's no permit.
All right, so let me just again just really focus, because if the arrests are simply for assembly without a permit, that's one thing. If the arrests are for the reality or the high risk of disruptive behavior, whether it's toward cars, whether it's toward other people, whether it's toward the police themselves, that's another matter. And if one reads the city's brief, you go through page upon page of allegations of disruptive behavior, although not, as I read it, by the time it gets up to Chicago Avenue. But is it your position, or is it your view, that this is really just about arresting people for marching without a permit?
Well, I would say that the district court's decision rested on that basis. I believe that the defendants have abandoned that basis and are now relying on vehemently disputed facts in the record that indicate there was criminal misconduct or other crimes committed throughout the course of this march. And I would agree with Your Honor that at Chicago and Michigan, there's disputed facts, but very little indication, but disputed facts about whether any crimes were being committed. Our plaintiffs agree there was no probable cause to arrest all 800 people at Chicago and Michigan. There was no indication of what crimes all 800 individuals had committed that would justify these arrests.
Now, would you agree, though, that if, counterfactually, you know, if this had been a gathering of 800 or 1,000 people in which violence was occurring, would the police at that point have the right to pick up anybody they saw, or do you think you would still need an individualized reason to pick up any particular person?
Well, I think if there was violence, the Chicago Police Department would certainly be entitled to stop the march and contain it. At that point, I believe they need individual particularized cause before they start arresting. Mm-hmm. And that's a clearly established right under the Supreme Court's precedent, under this court's precedent, and throughout various circuits across the country, that just because individuals are engaging in their First Amendment rights in a large protest, that in no way detracts from their Fourth Amendment rights to have their arrests based on individual particularized probable cause. And in this case, certainly that there is no undisputed evidence that their facts are in dispute as to whether any individuals.
Situations in a riot where they arrest everybody without making fine distinctions, right, might be necessary for public work. Let me ask you a different question. If we reversed, What are the factual issues for the trial?
Well, in this case, the district court properly determined that there are facts in dispute with respect to ratification. And
What's ratification?
Ratification is that the Chicago Police Department waived the permit requirement and enabled the march, and where they permitted the march to continue and to go on.
Why is that a factual issue? I don't understand.
Well, the defendants in this...
They don't dispute that they waived the permit, do they?
I believe they do.
Really?
The district court found that, and I believe they do. I think that those facts indicate in our...
So one fact is whether they waived the permit, and what would be other facts?
As to whether they terminated the ratification for the march. Although,
what does that mean, terminated the ratification?
Whether they indicated to the plaintiffs and the...
Notice. There has to be notice, you're saying. Right.
Right. We agree.
But whether there was notice that the time for the march was now over?
Yes, and that people had to leave. I mean, the primary issue for this jury...
How do they do notice?
Well, in this case, they give orders to disperse.
Bullhorns or what?
Yes, with bullhorns. The facts indicate that every single...
Do they use bullhorns?
The police?
They use bullhorns.
We have no... There are disputed facts in this record.
That's a dispute.
Yes,
right,
I mean...
So you have the waiver issue and the notice issue. What other factual issues?
I'd say the primary factual issue is whether orders to disperse were given to the plaintiffs.
Well, that's the notice issue. All right, what other issues are there, if
are,
any?
Are there disputed issues about the behavior of the crowd up on Chicago and Michigan?
There are some disputed issues. There are the defendants claim that there were individuals who were engaged in criminal damage to property. We absolutely dispute that individuals were. And where there's such disputes, that would be for a jury to determine whether at Chicago and Michigan.
Are there any other factual issues?
I would say that those are the primary factual issues.
Now, after those factual issues were... determined, then there'd have to be individual hearings, wouldn't there, for the 800 people?
Well, in this case, it's been certified as a class.
I know.
The police.
I know, but when you come to the matter of not only remedy but also right, don't you have to have a hearing for all 800? That is, some of them may have actually been violent. Some of them may have incurred different costs from others. Some separated from their kids. Who knows what? Right? Isn't that how a normal class action would work? You have the common issues of fact there and law. They're resolved, and if they're resolved in favor of the class, then you have individual hearings for the class members.
Well, certainly at the stage.
Individual relief as opposed to an injunction or declaration. But if you want damages, if the 800 people want damages, each has to prove his damages, right?
I agree in that this court and the district court, a jury can resolve the issue as to whether there was probable cause to justify the arrest.
Right. But I mean, what Judge Posner is describing is a very routine part of class actions. You must be asking for damages or we wouldn't be engaged in the qualified immunity inquiry.
Absolutely, we are asking for damages, and at this case, once there's a resolution on the false arrest claims as to the damages themselves, that may require individual hearings. However, we do have three subsets of classes that have distinct damages. There are some individual damages that are differing, and that may require separate hearings on damages.
Are you asking for injunctive relief also, or just damages?
At this point, we're asking for damages.
Okay. Thank you.
With respect to the city, it is also liable for the fact that Superintendent Hillard, who was directly a participant in the false arrest in this case, who was consulted with and helped made the decision to conduct this mass arrest, he was the final policymaker for the city.
So you need, of course, as you've already started to do, to distinguish your situation from Oriema, since it was the same city and the same superintendent. I know your distinction is that there may be some delegation in the employment area that doesn't exist in the police operations area, but does that mean every time he makes any decision of an operational nature that he is the city?
Well, this is a very unique situation. And there's very few situations where the superintendent is directly a participant in an arrest situation, which would fall under police operations. But yes, our position is that he is directly liable.
Because he was sitting there in the operations room monitoring everything.
Yes, and as the superintendent, he is the final policymaker for all police operational decisions. With the yellow and the white light, I'm reserving.
Well, that's going very far, though, right? Because, you know, if you're in a little town, the police superintendent will maybe consult on every arrest, right?
Well, in this, they may be, and in that case, in very small towns, they may be liable for creating policy.
Well, you'd have to look at the statutes in that town. I mean, if there's a police board that has operational control, then you'd be back in the delegation situation.
Yes. In this case, the city, pursuant to the Chicago Municipal Code, grants the superintendent final policy authority making decisions for police operations.
Does he report to anybody besides the mayor? Is there anyone?
There's no indication that he does not report to any single person. And the defendants have, in fact, agreed that he has no meaningful review and he does not need to consult with anyone in making this decision to mass arrest.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Mogul. Mr. Gorman?
Thank you. Good morning. May the court please, if I may, I would like to focus on the issues of civil conspiracy and malicious prosecution, which were ruled upon by Judge Kendall in her first opinion in the Beal case, which denied summary judgment on many claims and allowed it on others.
Well, why are your clients separate from the? Why weren't they folded into the class as another subclass?
They opted out and chose, as a matter of strategy, to pursue their independent claims.
So it's a B3 class, in other words, you're saying.
Right. Yeah. The district court, in ruling on the conspiracy and malicious prosecution claims, did not discuss them in any way.
No, wait. So are these just claims in your suit, or are they also in the class action? Big class action.
We have some similar claims. The class action has many issues that we don't have. However,
yours has the virtue of focusing on these individual people, and I suppose that might affect your strategy. What do you gain, though, by having these conspiracy claims if in fact Superintendent Hillard is a policymaker such that there's Monell liability, or if you can show that the police infringed the rights of your clients?
Well, it's an alternate avenue to liability. We don't know what the court's going to say about
it's an alternate way of bringing in the superintendent, right?
Right.
Doesn't add anything to anything else in the case.
Right. We don't know how this court's going to rule about Superintendent Hillard's liability, but we do think
the purpose of charging a civil conspiracy is to rope him in. But I don't understand. You're not trying to rope the city in, right?
We have a Monell claim also, yes.
So look, you have to go through this again. What does it add to charge a conspiracy here? I don't
know. It's just an alternate theory of liability.
What's the point? I mean, he violated the First and Fourth Amendments, or they didn't violate the First and Fourth Amendments, they nevertheless would be guilty of what? What's the tort?
We don't concede that they wouldn't be guilty of
tort. It's a way of getting, yanking people in for other, criminal law.
I wouldn't use the word yank, but we certainly want them in. We believe they're proper defendants, and this is a proper basis.
What are these? Are these accomplices or something that you're bringing in, or what?
Civil conspiracy.
If these police violated the First or Fourth Amendments, what do you gain by also saying they conspired?
Well, we don't know all of the individuals involved. Because
so what you're trying to prove is an agreement, and you're trying to attribute the acts of one member of this agreement to others who were in it, even if everybody didn't do everything?
Right. Conspiracy only requires
one. You don't know who they are. You can't get relief against them.
Well, they covered up their badges. That's why we say there's...
I know, but if you don't know who they are, you're not going to be able to get any money from them, right?
Under the conspiracy theory, we would. Because
if you don't know who they are, how do you get damages from them?
We know it's the Chicago Police Department.
So that gets you back to Monell, actually, because if it's John Smith, you know, and you don't know he was involved, you'll never get money from him. Have you conducted discovery to try to find out who these people were who had the covered-up badges?
Well, yes, we did.
I mean, surely the city must know who was assigned.
Well, what happened was we conducted discovery with the names of the officers who appeared on the arrest reports and the criminal complaints.
Right.
They admitted that their badges were covered up, and they don't know who made the actual arrest. So it's not possible to find out.
So you'd like to hold them liable as part of this effort to bring everybody in, because they at least played a role in some names?
Falsely signed arrest reports, appeared in court to prosecute, etc.
So is this a state law claim, this conspiracy claim?
We have it both under Section 1983 and under state law, so there's two counts.
State law violation.
It mirrors the federal claim. It's one or more people acting in concert to
the state violation?
Violation of the state constitution.
State constitution?
Right, which is count 7 of our complaint.
I don't understand you. Multiplication of claims. I don't see the point.
Well, it is what it is. We don't know what the court's going to let stand and what it is and what won't.
It's just a garbage pail of claims. Maybe one will stick, throw enough.
We don't think we put anything in here that doesn't belong in here, Judge. There's a basis for every count. Judge, the district court did not give any individualized attention to these claims as to the conspiracy and the false or malicious prosecution. All she said was reasonable jurors could not find under the circumstances that defendants played a role in the prosecution. That's clearly wrong. And that no reasonable juror could infer from the circumstances that defendants reached a meeting of the minds. But all the inferences favorable to plaintiff are that the police came with their name tags covered up, all of them, in full view of their superior officers. They engaged in mass forgeries, basically roundtabling complaints. They still appeared in court to prosecute these claims, even though none of them, for our particular plaintiffs, the Beal plaintiffs, had probable cause to believe any of them had committed a crime. And many of these officers admitted, we didn't see anybody committing crimes. So that's the basis of the conspiracy theory and the malicious prosecution.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Gorman.
Thank you.
Ms. Layton?
May it please the Court. Your Honors, on March 20th, 2003, thousands and thousands of people took over Chicago streets for an
I don't understand this business of you can't get a permit without a date. I don't understand that.
Well, Your Honor, the form, yes, technically does require...
I don't care what the form is. What is the thinking behind not giving people a permit for a date rather than having an ad hoc waiver?
The purpose of the permit requirement, Your Honor, is...
I know what the purpose of a permit requirement is. I'm asking you, what is the purpose of not allowing the permit to be issued without a date? Because it's somehow... The demonstration is tied to an event, imminent but not known exactly when it'll start. And they want to time their demonstration with this triggering event. So why can't you give them a permit or deny the permit? Give them a permit and say, look, you have to go here and there and you can have X number of people and this and that.
I'm not clear that the rules don't permit you to at least get the wheels in motion started for a permit.
I'm asking you why you can't get a permit, permit, not wheels in motion, a permit, without a date. Is there a reason for that?
I don't know the reason why you can't actually issue the permit.
I don't understand. Have you thought about this, that maybe it's kind of dumb what they did?
Your Honor,
to let the wheels go in motion without knowing exactly what's going to be done.
A permit allows the police to prepare for a particular event on a particular
date. And of course, to prepare.
But if
they'd like to know exactly where the march is going to be.
Right.
And if they had a permit which said that when this triggering event occurs, you're going to march here and not there, and you're going to block this traffic and not that traffic, wouldn't that make life a lot easier for everybody?
Certainly, Your Honor. It would make life a lot easier if the plaintiff...
No. Wouldn't what I am suggesting make life a lot easier?
Yes. If the plaintiffs had been able to get...
That's right. You answer my question. I can go on to something else.
Okay. Well, but I wanted to follow up actually indirectly because, interestingly enough, in your brief... It makes it very clear that marches without permits are a common event in Chicago. And this is the brief you filed in the City of Chicago. Actually, you sort of got two briefs, but anyway, it's the one that says City of Chicago, where you say the CPD wanted the march to proceed northbound on Dearborn. And then at the top of page 8, interestingly, you say, which is the standard route for unpermitted marches. Now, for it to be a standard route, it has to be something that the police are quite familiar with. And I mean, you couldn't have used that word had it not been pretty clear.
Well, Your Honor, the police certainly do make an effort to accommodate marchers who are interested in expressing their First Amendment rights.
I actually think this whole permit issue in this case, in some sense, is a red herring. The police work with this large demonstration. It goes on for many, many hours, and a lot of the facts in your briefs are not really pertinent to the claims of the plaintiffs before us, because by the time these claims arise, it's evening. It's actually rather dark outside if one watches the videos. You can see all these people milling around, and it's probably the numbers have dropped off by that time, but it bears little resemblance to what you're talking about. Whatever may have gone on earlier, the police were in total control about where people were going to be.
The police were not in total control at the point that the march neared Oak Street on Lakeshore Drive.
None of the claims that I'm aware of in this case focus there. We get to the point where everybody's on Chicago Avenue, Michigan Avenue is at one end, Mies van der Rohe, or perhaps maybe a little bit further, I'm not sure, say Mies van der Rohe is at the other end. Whatever had happened earlier about permits or no permits just doesn't seem to me to be terribly pertinent.
Our argument does not turn on the permit or the lack of permit, Your Honor. Our argument turns on...
create a problem, though, if the district judge thought that the reason these arrests were warranted was because there was no permit for the march?
No, Your Honor, because there was...
The court's relying on irrelevant reasons.
Because there was... The police had ordered the protesters, by the time that they deceived the police and exited the Lakeshore Drive at Oak Street, rushing towards Michigan Avenue...
I understand. The police didn't want them to go on to Michigan Avenue.
Correct.
Take Michigan. Okay, that I understand. But once they're blocked, and they're on Chicago Avenue, why not just let them, just tell them, you know, go back and go, you know,
the police
can't go to Michigan,
them
so let them
numbers.
Go. Why pen them in and then arrest them?
Well, that's not when we're at the point in time when the march is at Oak and Michigan. The police drew a line across and said, you can't go to Michigan. The police then did say, you must go back the way you came. Turn around. And in fact, the march did. And in fact, the plaintiffs concede that that message was
conveyed.
Why do
you have to arrest anybody if they were marching back away from Michigan?
They were doing what the police told them to do.
Because they didn't do exactly what the police told them to do.
What were they doing exactly?
Because what they were doing, and this is from the perspective of Commander Griffin, who was the officer, the commanding personnel who ordered the original arrest, on every street...
Well, you really ought to have uncontradicted facts if you want to make factual representations.
Yes, Your Honor. We certainly understand the summary judgment standard. However, the plaintiffs have not put in issue Commander Griffin's perspective.
But that's subjective. I mean, if you look, you're trying to get these people back to Federal Plaza, apparently. Somebody makes a decision, perhaps Commander Griffith, perhaps Superintendent Hilliard, I'm not sure, to... draw a line at Michigan Avenue, okay, and then these people, from their point of view, are penned in, and there they stay, and the police don't tell them to disperse, the police don't start letting people out at 5-minute intervals, one at a time, they don't do anything that would allow people peacefully to leave in a way that would give the police some assurance that Michigan Avenue isn't just going to fill up with a lot of people.
Because, Your Honor, this may help, because their perspective starts back at the time at Oak in Michigan, Chicago.
Why not? Why is that undisputed?
Because at the time that the marchers ended up on Chicago Avenue, an objective officer in the command personnel's position would have reasonable belief that every single one of them was there in violation of police orders. The police had, at Oak Street, ordered them to turn around, go back to Federal Plaza the way you came. That's not what they did.
Why does that justify the police arresting people who aren't doing anything?
They're not arresting people that aren't doing anything, Your
Honor.
They're
singing the Star Spangled Banner.
Everyone who got onto Chicago Avenue, and again, this might help. Remember, at Oak in Michigan, the march was 8,000 strong. By the time they got to Chicago and Michigan, the numbers had dwindled to only 1,000 or 2,000 strong. A lot of people did do what the police asked. Go back the way you came. Disperse. Don't go to Michigan. But there was a group that Commander Griffin literally had to chase down on each of the side streets south of Oak as they attempted to breach the police lines and get to Michigan. They outrun him.
Why is that disputed? I can certainly understand you arguing to a jury that this was the situation. But it seems that there's evidence in the record to suggest that it wasn't this very tense situation that you're describing.
If it had been just Commander Griffin arresting one person, then yes, they could create a fact contest by saying, we didn't see or hear what you did.
So why
but in a march,
this woman who left the meeting with her briefcase and the police won't let her go over to the Red Line station on Chicago Avenue, what was she doing?
We're not saying that probable cause, of course, is a different analysis than whether they could have convicted her for a crime.
I understand that perfectly well, but I'm wondering why, it sounds like a police state, frankly. You know, if a large crowd of peaceful people can all just be swept up and arrested by the police, even if people are not doing anything at that moment, they're staying in the area that the police have defined for them, they're waiting to be able to go home.
Because there was probable cause to believe that every single person that made it onto Chicago Avenue had violated the law.
At Oak in Michigan, you say they ordered them back to Federal Plaza. How did they order them back? They used bullhorns?
Commander Griffin and Commander Reesley.
Bullhorns or what?
Bullhorns were used, Your Honor. The command personnel consulted with the march leaders, and the leaders themselves testified that they told or started telling the crowd, including...
But now, between Lakeshore Drive and Michigan, Oak Street between Lakeshore Drive and Michigan is several blocks. Mm-hmm. So is the proposition that they used a means of dispersal, bullhorns or what have you, that would actually be heard by everybody in that stretch?
A means of dispersal.
Yes or no?
Yes, Your Honor, yes. There was a means of dispersal used.
Answer my question. Would everybody have heard those bullhorns?
As to whether or not everybody heard, it's whether the...
Well, if people didn't hear... Then they might go to Chicago not knowing they had been ordered back to Federal Plaza, right?
It's objectively reasonable for Commander Griffin to believe that everyone had gotten the message.
It was objectively, it was reasonable for him. He's the fellow at Chicago?
He's one of the fellows at Chicago, yes.
It's reasonable for him to believe that anybody who was in Chicago Avenue was probably someone who knew about the order to return to Federal Plaza and was defying it. That's your case.
That's our position.
And so your position, too, is that a bullhorn that's held at Michigan and Oak can convey a voice all the way over to Lakeshore Drive?
No, Your Honor, we don't have to take that position.
Well,
it's not necessary for one bullhorn.
Of course you have to take that position. First of all, that's ridiculous. You couldn't hear a bullhorn.
Of course, and we don't take that position.
Okay, but that means you've got... A whole bunch of people on Oak who go to Chicago, yes, they want to take Michigan maybe, but they go to Chicago. They're not going to actually charge a police line. They're in Chicago. They don't know that they've been ordered back to Federal Plaza. All they know is that people are moving back from Michigan. The flow is reversed.
Right, exactly.
And they go back into Chicago. Now, how do they know, if they didn't hear the bullhorn, that they're forbidden to be in Chicago?
There wasn't just one bullhorn. I mean, the question...
Okay, what else were there? There were 1,000 bullhorns.
There were protesters that were themselves conveying the message to the people behind them.
And
that's admitted by the plaintiffs.
Every single person in Oak learned of the order to return to Federal Plaza? Is that your proposition?
We don't take that position. We don't have to take that position.
Suppose 1,000 didn't.
We don't have to take that position. We only have to take the position that it was reasonable for Commander Griffin to believe under the circumstances.
How could he think that everybody in these thousands of people knew that they shouldn't be on Chicago?
Because he saw the march leaders conveying that message to the people and the
crowd
turned around.
How many people were on Oak?
There were 8,000 to 10,000 people.
Well, how could the march leaders convey to 8,000 people that they should go back to Federal Plaza?
Also, the entire crowd did, in fact, turn around and start going back.
That route that showed the police leave open to go back to Federal Plaza.
Inner Lakeshore Drive.
But isn't there evidence that the police told some people to go west on Chicago? We were going south on Lakeshore Drive, and the police told them to go west.
That is the plainest testimony. You're correct,
Your
Honor.
Well, that's the facts, and there are some facts in the record.
But it turns on the perspective of the command personnel who were out in front of the march, because it was a march of 1,000 people. The people at the back that were testifying.
If you're trying to say these people did something wrong, are they supposed to be mind readers? Are they supposed to know what was inside Commander Griffin's
head? And
that
perhaps would have entitled them to be acquitted, but that's not the...
Look, this is ridiculous. These people were not charging the police. They were not endangering Griffin. Let me ask you about the Monell case. We have this Exhibit 6, this Chicago Police Department General Order 0211. Isn't this the policy statement about how you handle demonstrations?
Sure, Your Honor, it is.
Sure. And who signed it?
It's signed by the superintendent.
Well, doesn't that make him the policymaker for dealing with demonstrations?
No, Your Honor, because the task force...
Well, who is the policymaker, then?
It's not a question of...
Would you please?
Sorry, Your Honor.
Who makes policy for demonstrations if the only document is this Exhibit 6 and it's signed by the police superintendent?
City Council has the power to write policy for the
police department.
But it
doesn't write it.
The test for who is a policymaker turns on...
No official in Chicago who has policymaking authority. It's just the City Council?
Is
that your proposition? That your proposition, yes or no?
Yes, Your Honor.
The mayor is not a policymaker, just the City Council.
With respect to the...
The mayor is not a policymaker. Answer my question. Don't fence with me.
No, Your Honor.
The mayor is not a policymaker in Chicago.
Well, okay. Wait a minute. Let's go back to the Supreme Court's decision in City of St. Louis against Kropotnick. There, the court says, the challenged action must have been taken pursuant to a policy adopted by the official or officials responsible under state law for making policy in that area of
Correct.
The city's business. Now, the fact that Illinois one day might amend its constitution, or the General Assembly might amend the Home Rule statute, or the city of Chicago might completely turn inside out the way it runs the police department, I think does not undermine the existing state of affairs. We have to look at state law as it exists, and it looks to me like, as it existed at the time of this march, Superintendent Hilliard was indeed the policymaker, because that's what the state of the law was then. Yes, could it be amended? Fine. We could change a lot of things.
This court has already held in Oriema that the superintendent of the police department is not a policymaker based on an ordinance.
That's why I stress in that area. Mm-hmm. We don't overrule the Supreme Court. They overrule us. And Oriema was looking at an area where there was an authority higher than the superintendent.
But the same exact ordinance in Oriema applies in this case.
But it carves out operations.
It doesn't say anything different. What the ordinance says is that the police... The superintendent's, what he does, is constrained by what the city council writes. I am paraphrasing.
Suppose the city council said, we're delegating to the superintendent policy with regard to demonstrations. And suppose this police superintendent said, well, I think the best policy dealing with demonstrations is to hit demonstrators over the head with batons. Okay? And you're saying that the city would not be liable for the consequences of this policy. Is that what you're saying?
No. We're saying
a
delegation.
Why would there be liability in that case?
Well, if there's a delegation of the final authority to write the rules, which is what the test is, who has the final word on writing rules, then that's one thing. But they don't have evidence that. In fact, they have
the
contrary evidence.
I'm asking the questions. I know we're very rude. We're always interrupting lawyers and tormenting them. But that's just the play. If the city council delegates authority to an official, it can, of course, always withdraw that delegation. It always has the authority to overrule it. Suppose in my hypothetical case, the police superintendent comes to the council and he says, I have this great policy. There's never going to be another demonstration in our city because, you know, my policy is to brain these people. The city council could say, well, you've gone too far. You'll have to change your policy. They could do that, right?
Correct.
That would be just like this case, right?
The city council hasn't delegated anything. The city council has not delegated.
Obviously, there's a delegation, right?
There's a delegation.
You're not contending this document is unauthorized.
No, but what we are saying is that does not delegate the correct thing. That does not delegate the authority to write final rules for...
What's the final rule? This is the only rule there is.
That has to be consistent with what the city council writes by virtue of ordinance.
Is this a non-final rule?
The federal constitution. I don't know what you get out of saying it has to be consistent with the city's ordinances.
Well, Your Honor, we would submit that even if this court finds Superintendent Hillard to be a policymaker, that is not relevant because they have no evidence that he caused their injury. He did nothing but sit in the command center the entire time. He did not order their arrest. He did not have evidence of that.
They're not interested in Superintendent Hilliard. They're interested in the city.
Right. If he's a policymaker by virtue of whose actions can bind the city, if the city can be held liable based on what our policymaker does, and Superintendent Hilliard is a policymaker, they still have no claim because he did not do anything to cause their injuries.
Well, he did something. He's got this goofy permit business and a waiver of permit and all that. He's done all that.
I'm not sure that actually caused the injuries they're complaining about in this case, Your Honor.
Well, I think it did. I think it did. If there had been a permit without a date, I don't think they would have this problem because they would have known exactly what to do. That, you know, I'm sure all these permits say that the permit can be revoked and would say what happens if it's revoked. They'd have to go back to Federal Plaza via Lakeshore Drive, right? And then you wouldn't have had this problem.
And isn't he also in command of the whole operation from watching it by video and radio? And isn't the command also calling up all the local police stations and saying, get ready, there's going to be a big arrest and all that? I mean, he's clearly running the show, isn't he?
He's in command, but he would have to have reason to know that the arrests that were made were going to be unconstitutional.
Well, he's watching
in
all
order
this.
But he didn't because there's an arrest made doesn't mean it's an unconstitutional one if the officers had probable cause.
Well, if they're peaceful, if the demonstrators are peaceful and there's evidence to that effect, then he orders the arrest or acquiesces it. Isn't that what caused the arrest?
But an unlawful arrest, even if peaceful, the demonstrators can still be subject to arrest if they're blocking traffic, blocking emergency services, and impeding access and disobeying police orders not to go to Michigan Avenue. Just briefly, Your Honors, if I may, the Beal way, just wanted to point out that the claims that they are now, the Illinois Constitution claim that they mentioned this morning and the malicious prosecution claims that they've asserted are the malicious prosecution claim against the city in particular was waived because it did not get raised until the reply brief. And the Illinois Constitution claim, although it was mentioned on page 46 in their opening brief in the false arrest section, that was waived by failing to develop the argument.
Okay,
unless
thank
there
you,
are
Ms.
further
Slate.
Questions, we respectfully ask the court to affirm. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, so Mr. Mogul, do you have anything further, or Mr. Gorman? Ms. Mogul, I mean, sorry.
Time permitting, with respect to any orders that were given at Oak in Michigan and at Chicago in Michigan, those are vehemently disputed, and there's no evidence.
I didn't hear you.
Those orders, as to whether they are given, are disputed in the record. As to the issue with respect to Superintendent Hilliard as a policymaker, as this court noted in Pembauer, the Supreme Court found that there can be a policymaker for certain decisions and a policymaker for other decisions. In this case, as this court's articulated, it's clear that Superintendent Hilliard was the final policymaker with respect to the decision to order the mass arrest at the demonstration. With respect to his participation, not only did he monitor the entire march, but he was in consultation with the commanders from the beginning, its inception, to its end. The facts with respect to his participation in ordering the arrest are also in dispute, and it's for a jury to determine and resolve his participation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Mogul. Mr. Gorman, do you have anything further?
I would like to point out that none of the plaintiffs in these cases were charged with anything to do with permit violations. They were charged with reckless conduct, and as such, they were all entitled to an evaluation of individualized probable cause. The fact that somebody else may have done something does not make them subject to arrest. The probable cause for the individuals has to be individually thought about, and it has to be there individually. None of the plaintiffs here engaged in anything remotely resembling reckless conduct, and they shouldn't have been arrested and charged with that. We, the Beal plaintiffs, ask, of course, that the district court be reversed. The court did find in its first order on Beal that there were issues as to whether the demonstration was infected with violence or not, and that there were issues as to whether or not dispersal orders were given. All of the Beal plaintiffs say they never heard any dispersal orders. They could not walk back to Federal Plaza, even if that was the order, because the police would not allow them to. They blocked off Inner Lakeshore Drive at Chicago to pen them in on Chicago Avenue for the purpose of making these arrests. We ask that the court, this court remand and exercise its discretion under Rule 36 to a different district judge. We feel that the judge has not recognized that the Beal plaintiffs have opted out of this case. They've treated the Beal plaintiffs as members of the class when they're not, and had not even given the Beal plaintiffs a chance to respond to summary judgment arguments that were made in BODAC.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gorman, and Ms. Mogul, and Ms. Layton.